and Roberta Maria Atti.
Hi, everybody. This is Armand DeMille.
And this is Roberta Maria Atti.
Here with you at The Pocket of Mind, WBAI 99.5 FM in your dial. Bringing you ideas, concepts, and guests to help you lead a more positively minded life. Some exciting programming coming today. How is it, you know, the classic argument between every husband and wife where the wife is saying to the husband, I want you to feel more. And a husband says, but I don't. And I want you to have the reactions I have. And the guy says, I don't. Or the opposite, too. Sometimes the husband could be feeling these deep emotional feelings and the wife could say, nope, I'm just cold. I'm collected. There are some people who never get angry. There are some people who never feel love. Some people who never get jealous. Wouldn't that be great? Imagine if you could never feel grief. No grief, no jealousy, no anger. Wouldn't that be wonderful? Well, you may have to give up feeling joy, too. And you give up feeling a couple of other things, and we have a condition called alexithymia. A very interesting condition that we've been studying, and it becomes more and more important, especially to any of you practitioners out there, because so many times you meet people who look like they feel things, but they don't feel anything. Actually, they have no feelings at all. Research going back to 1972 has unearthed a lot of information about alexithymia. That's what it's called, alexithymia. The word "a" comes from the Greek. Whenever you have the "a" at the beginning, it means lack of. Lexa, which is words, lack of words. Thymia, which is feelings. So it really in Greek means a lack of words for feelings, but it's not just having a poor vocabulary. It means not being able to feel your feelings or identify your feelings.
And it sounds very intriguing and very maybe appealing, Armand, when you ask people, would you like not to fear the uncomfortable feelings? But actually, it's not that we don't feel them. It's that we feel them, but we don't know we're feeling them. So that the emotion cannot be avoided. The emotion is going through the organism, but the mind does not know, and therefore the mind does not know how to attach words to it, for instance.
Well, wait, now this is in the case of alexithymia. You're saying we. You mean the people who are alexithymic feel these feelings in their bodies. The feelings are taking place.
Well, yes, I was talking about we. It was a, you know, rhetorical way of saying.
French way of saying, yes.
Right. That,
the we.
That is, it's not that these emotions go away or that they can be eliminated. The perception of them can be eliminated. And there are many different kinds of this, what should we call it, Armand? Disorder, dysfunction.
Disconnection. But we should explain, Roberta, that it is not just what everybody's been listening to, because now you're all going to say, oh, yeah, that sounds like psychopathy. Oh, yeah, that sounds like repression. No. We're talking about something very different here. Very different than psychopathy, than repressed emotions. We're talking about a complete inability to identify, not even identify, but react to any emotion. So you have an emotion inside, somewhere in the body. I'll give you an example. An alexithymic person, they may feel fear, and they don't know they're feeling fear. And then their body clenches. And then their body pulls together and it gets really tight. Their stomach clenches and it secretes certain gastric juices and it shoots blood clotting mechanism through their body. The person who is alexithymic says, not I'm afraid, as many of us would be able to identify from the constellation of sensations, but they say, I have an upset stomach.
Right, which is also known as somatizing, which means to put something that belongs to the mind in the body, and it's not that the person does not know that that something is happening, but they cannot recognize it the way that most people do. Also, let's say, for instance, you put a picture in front of this individual that shows something that is normally repulsive, upsetting, scary, disturbing. And so you see this person looking at the picture, and you see that they are reacting with the same signs that they are registering the image as everybody else. But when you ask them, how are you feeling? They don't say, oh, I'm feeling disturbed, upset, sad. They say, I'm feeling fine. And they mean it, because in reality, even though they're undergoing all of the symptoms, all of the physiological reactions, their mind is blank, is disconnected from what they are experiencing.
So what you might see is a person with a flat affect looking at all of this, but if you had their body sensitized with all kinds of judging mechanisms, you know, if you had could take in their pulse and you were taking their gastric juices, you'd see they'd be having the very same reaction, but they're not aware of it. Here is how do you tell if you're alexithymic? Well, number one, you may find it difficult to talk about your own emotions. You might find it difficult. You might find throughout the history of time, if people said, what do you feel, you just can't talk about it.
Well, the person might say, I don't know. I'm not feeling anything.
Right.
Or they might say, well, what do you mean, what am I feeling? They don't even know why you're asking the question.
You know what? You want to know what answer I like? Well, I feel fine.
Well, that's actually what they say most of the time.
Most of the time.
But I just wanted to say that there's a disconnection even verbally from the emotion. There are no words attached.
How do you tell if you're alexithymic? You may be perceived by others as being excessively logical or unsentimental without being unfriendly. You know, you're not unfriendly because there are certain types that are very unemotional and excessively logical, but they're unfriendly. No, the alexithymic person is not a bad person. They just don't have this mechanism, and we're going to describe how that happens, because it could be happening physiologically or it could be happening psychologically, and there's enough stuff that we've uncovered that it's just fascinating. Another way to identify it is that they give pedantic and long-winded answers to practical questions. Did you ever meet anybody like that? How do you get around the corner? And the question, the answer, tends to just flow out of their mind, and it doesn't stop. They don't stop talking. We don't know why that's associated with the absence of emotions, but it is.
Maybe as a way to compensate?
Yeah, one would imagine. Mm. You give pedantic and long... Okay, now another one, which is fascinating about whether or not you are alexithymic or someone you know is... They rarely daydream or fantasize anything emotional. Now, that's very interesting. If you think about your own daydreams and fantasies, are your juices going when you're daydreaming? You know, are you feeling wonderful? Like you daydream about a person you love, and you feel wonderful inside. You're having an emotional reaction. You daydream, you fantasize about somebody you hate. Right? You think about, you know, hitting him on the head with a brick or something. You have an emotional reaction inside. In most daydreams and fantasies, you're having emotional response. In fact, the purpose of daydreams and fantasies is to get the emotional juices going. Interesting thing.
Also, the inability to differentiate between different emotions, so that the alexithymic person may be... sad, with all of the signs and symptoms and with the tears and the facial expression that signifies sadness, and they may say that they are scared, for instance. Or they may say that they're angry.
Well, that's a little confusing. We're going to have to give you a little more sophisticated look to get into that. Because now we have two definitions going on here, Roberta. One is, I'm saying you don't feel it, and you're saying, oh, yes, you may show the symptoms of it. My understanding of alexithymia is that there are rarely any symptoms on your face, that they're in your body. Your body is having the emotional reaction. Your face is not necessarily showing it. In fact, it rarely talks about tears. Tears almost don't exist for the alexithymic. They're very rare. Now, another thing about alexithymia, which is fascinating, is they have a subdued reaction to art, literature, and music. You've got to see it. I mean, I'm sure you've seen it in your life. A whole group of people who think, no, it's nice. Art, it's worth a second. Literature, that's interesting. Music, I could take it or leave it. Because they don't have the emotional connection that is meant to come up from art, literature, and music. Now, again, as we said, there are people with repressed feelings, which is different than alexithymia. We're going to talk more about alexithymia, the actual disorder, and give you definitions that are going to help you sort out these two. The other thing that may be a sign of whether or not you have this syndrome is you may suffer occasional inexplainable or inexplicable physiological disturbances, such as palpitations, stomach aches, hot flashes, stuff like that. You don't know why they're going on, and boom, they kind of hit you all over the place. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We are talking about alexithymia, emotional dullness. It's kind of a dull feeling that you've seen in people. It's the inability to talk about your feelings due to a lack of emotional awareness. I'm going to talk a little more about it, but let me read you a story. Let me read you something I read about a patient who was brought into an emergency room. Kisha, 16, was brought to the emergency room by her mother after she held a curling iron to the outside of her upper left arm, causing a large painful burn. Kisha had just started her junior year in high school and also worked as a cashier in a convenience store. She was an average student, but her mother assured me she was one of the most popular girls in her class. Kisha lived with her parents, two sisters, and a brother. She had never used illicit drugs or abused alcohol. I'm a virgin, she said easily and proudly when I asked if she had a current boyfriend, which she did not. Kisha denied physical and sexual abuse, and her mother later corroborated that. Asthma, occasional bronchitis, seasonal allergies were her only concessions to good health. Kisha acknowledged feeling depressed recently, although she did not admit to having any of the symptoms of a major depressive episode. Her appetite had not changed. She was sleeping up to 10 hours a day, which was normal for her. Asked how she felt during the interview, Kisha answered with an easy smile, "I feel fine." Now remember, this lady was burning her arms with an iron. It seemed to me the happy face owed more to practice than to spontaneity. I doubted her affect. This is what the physician was asking. When I asked Kisha why she burned herself so seriously, she looked at me blankly and said she didn't know. She denied anything had changed in her life recently. She acknowledged no disappointment or setback. According to Kisha, everything was fine. The burn that brought Kisha to the emergency room on the evening I interviewed her was not her first act of self-mutilation. 7 months earlier, she jumped out of a second-story window. Inexplicably, she did not go to a hospital, either for medical treatment or for psychiatric evaluation. During the previous year, Kisha had also made modest cuts with a razor on the underside of her forearms and on her cheek. "I was just bored," she said. Asked why she jumped out of the window, her response was, "I have no idea." Despite my persistent efforts to elicit more information about the reason for Kisha's self-destructive behavior, she did not offer a scintilla of explanation. That she was acknowledging no reasons for why she had not done, why she did what she did. Now, Kisha's mother said, she keeps it all on the inside. So clearly, Keisha was not only a minimizer, which many people do, but she had other feelings that Keisha's mother noticed, that Keisha noticed that she rarely feels disappointments, that she rarely feels the kind of things that most kids would respond to. So Keisha had no words for her feelings that led her to do these things, but in knowledge, her silence spoke volumes. Clearly, she had emotions, but she did not acknowledge or understand them. This is when I decided that there was a little more to it than just somebody denying their feelings, that there were actually people out there who cannot feel what they feel. Now, this is fascinating because then the research goes back and you could look at people who were having strong emotional reactions back in the 20s. You remember prefrontal lobotomies, Roberta?
Well, no, because I was not born, but I know that there was such a time when the frontal lobotomy was not yet been discovered. But then, really, the first use, the reason why frontal lobotomy and many other of the preferred surgeries that are done to the brain is really to control emotional states in someone who is so emotionally intense that intensity could be a threat to their life or well-being, because in effect what Armand was describing with this young woman, he was describing someone who is feeling very intense emotions, but she's not able to connect with the awareness, and so these emotions have no other outlet but to show up in some behavior and in some physiological sign and or symptom. So this was done in the beginning of the in the 1900s and 1930. This was done on purpose to some people when some people were considered hysterical, when some people were considered overly emotionally expressive, overly emotionally involved, when some people would go into these bouts of hysteria where they would roll on the floor and scream and cry. What they would did is they would go inside their the corpus callosum and they would go snip, snip. And
you know what? Wait, let's just a little more scientific than that. What you do in Roberta's book of how to do a prefrontal lobotomy, go in the corpus callosum and go snip, snip.
Well, it's, you know.
What they would do is take a scalpel and go up through the nasal cavity to the frontal part of the brain, and they didn't know exactly what they were doing. They didn't have any x-rays to look at. What they would do is they would make a couple of cuts. And they found out that these lesions, if they made them in many cases, took a person who had been extremely dynamically emotional and brings them out, and they would be completely non-emotional.
Right. So this is just one of the surgeries, because there are many kinds of let's say, disconnections. There could be a sensorial disconnection. In other words, one could be seeing something and not aware that he or she is seeing it, even though all of the reactions to seeing it are there. One could be hearing something and not be aware that they're hearing it. One could be smelling something. So there are many situations in which the mind is able to disconnect from what it is experiencing. But then the intensity of that experience may flood the body with an intense behavior or an intense expression, and it's almost like the body has to pick up whatever the mind is not showing. Now, we, in history of this syndrome, in the history of it, it was believed that most of this alexithymia and most of these conditions were psychologically generated. But with the technology that we have today, and therefore with the ability that we have to go into the body and to look at all the tissues and to be able to really look at the details of the connections in the brain and in the nervous system, now we know that for some people, it may not be psychological only.
What they found with alexithymia specifically is that there are two types. What they call two types. One type is type A and one type is type B. Now, the reason I mention the lobotomy is I want to get you to a picture of the brain. Just think about what it takes to feel an emotion. What does it take? An emotion takes place in your mind somewhere, in your brain somewhere, and then it takes place all over your body. So there's a circuitry. In this circuitry, your mind, your emotions, your senses, they all kind of get together to feed back to you some information about what you feel. For example, if you hurt your toe, information goes to the brain to tell you you hurt your toe, and you know it's your toe. There's a certain amount of circuitry that tells you about your emotions. You experience an emotion like fear, for example. Well, of course the body's going to give you a feedback loop about fear. Let's say you're out on the tundra. And you're somewhere in Africa, and you're just out on the plains, and you're somebody, there are two guys. One guy is alexithymic, and the other guy is not. The guy who's not alexithymic is going to sense danger, and his body is going to react as soon as he can hear some kind of rumbling or feel some kind of rumbling under his feet. He's going to get a sense of danger, and he's going to feel fear before it actually occurs to him that something's going on. Like you see birds who take off and get on flight. Like I'm sure during the tsunami, the animals that were like running up the mountains before the wave hit. A sense, something senses that says to you, here's the emotion, it's fear, you use it to survive. If you're alexithymic, you don't feel that feeling.
Or you may be feeling a stomachache.
You may say, I've got a stomachache, I better take something, I better do something for it, but you will not feel the emotion fear. Okay, so there are two ways that you could have this alexithymia. Two ways. Type A, type B. If you imagine the circuit that we were built with, this circuitry that says you are going to be aware of your emotions, if something physiologically damages some part of the brain that cuts a gap, that stops the connection, let's say a lesion, a cut in the brain, you know, like we did with the prefrontal lobotomies. Let's say some reason you have either genetically or through an accident. Boom, a little cut in the brain. A little part that separates some part of the cycle. What are the most common places where these cuts take place or these disconnections take place?
Often between the limbic system and the neocortex, the limbic system being the seat of emotions.
And that's at the base of
cortex,
the skull.
Yes, and it's like a brain stem and the medulla oblongata and the amygdala. And the cortex is the top of the brain, which is the site of the intellect. So normally, one would register an emotion in the limbic system through the action of dopamine, among other neurotransmitters, and then that impulse would go to the cortex and say, you're feeling this and that. But if the limbic system and the cortex are not connected, if there is a lesion along the pathway between the two of them, then the person body is feeling it, but not the person's intellect. So the person could be sitting there with a stomachache saying, I have to take, you know, Tum, and the other one could be running away because there's the tsunami behind them. Or, here's another interesting one, the two hemispheres of the brain are connected through a body that has a nice name, I like it, corpus callosum. And this is a place where it's like a bridge between the left and right hemisphere. Well, if you separate the two hemispheres right there, very often something may be registered in the right hemisphere, but then not the awareness may not be there in the left.
So if you lose a circuitry that connects the right to the left, or if you lose a circuitry that connects the top of the head down to the base
of
the neck.
Those are just a couple of
examples. These are a couple of examples. Right. These can be the causes of that kind of disconnection. Think about how many children have been beaten. I have seen children who have come to my clinic, who have consulted with me, who were beaten as children. They were beaten. Now, how many times can you hit a kid before you damage them? Damage to the brain, you know, I know parents who shake kids and they like to shake them and shake them and shake them. Well, you can really do physical damage to a skull. I know a kid who once fell down off a banister, cracked his skull open, right, and was punished for it. So this kind of stuff happens to you, and then, after a while, you no longer feel the pain. Look at the convenience of the way the body created, took whatever the damage was and said, well, you can't afford to feel this stuff anymore, because if you feel it, you're probably going to react, and if you react, you're going to get angry, and they're probably going to kill you. So shut off your feelings. Don't feel anything. And how many people who are damaged children, especially people who are abused children, you look at and they're vacant. They're numb. They don't feel anything. And they'll tell you, I had a happy childhood. Because they're just not aware of what goes on. This is the kind of phenomena that takes place physiologically. It's the beginning. Physiologically, if you have alexithymia with some kind of a lesion in the brain, you're in danger. Because you could possibly die from that.
You could die because you are not in touch. If you're not in touch with your emotions, then your decisions, your decisional ability may be impaired, to say the least, and your ability to respond appropriately to situations, danger, other people, all of that may become impaired.
And you can't even tell the difference between emotional and physical damage.
Right.
Because it all goes under one lump. This is Armand DeMille. We're going to have to tell you more about that when we get back. Very exciting stuff. And with Roberta Maria Atti, we're talking to you. We won't be able to cover it all today. Certainly next Wednesday we'll pick up the second part. Tomorrow, Thursday, I'm speaking with the head of the Washington Square Institute, who's written a couple of books on depression and sexuality. He'll be with me tomorrow, so you may want to tune in for that as well. If you need it, if you can't stay with us today and you needed a copy of today's program, you'd call 212-757-4488. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Maria Atti. We're going to take a short break, play you a little soft music, and come back, and we'll tell you why your husband can't feel things. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Danny Glover.
This is Saul Williams.
And this is Michael Frank.
Okay, stand by, Armand.
I listener-supported, non-commercial radio in New York.
This is Reverend Jesse Jackson on the Rainbow Push Coalition. Please call and support WBAI, non-commercial peace and justice radio in New York.
Yeah. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with you with the positive mind. You wouldn't believe that is Clifford Brown with strings. Clifford Brown with strings. Might want to get that album. It's one of my all-time favorites. Clifford Brown, being one of the greatest trumpet players that ever lived, had his life cut short by an accident, but he was doing terrific, terrific, beautiful work. And the name of the song is Willow Weep For Me, which I thought was appropriate for today's theme because, you know, sometimes if nothing's going to weep for you, you may as well have a willow weep for you because it'll save your life. In fact, Alfred Lord Tennyson. Here's a poem. Home they brought her warrior dead. Home they brought her warrior dead. They brought a warrior dead, right? Home they brought her warrior dead. She nor swooned nor uttered cry. All her maidens watching said, she must weep or she will die. That's a big poem.
It really says why this is important and why it's important to talk about it, Armand, because starting all the way back from when Freud was doing his studies on hysteria, what we have seen is that when people are, for whatever reason, as a result of abuse, as a result of post-traumatic stress disorder, as a result, like the Vietnam veterans, for instance, a lot of them are numb. Right. And if, for whatever reason, this has happened to an individual, the risk is that the mind and the body being separate and not connected, that the body may end up being the one that pays the price. And what we are saying is that for most of these conditions and syndromes, there are interventions that can really restructure, redirect, and can somehow repair. So we think it's important to talk about this because if we're talking about people who cannot connect with their emotions, the brain is able to sprout neurons at will. Sprout neurons is like snip, snip.
As we get back, listen, this is Armand DeMille. If you just tuned in because you were listening to beautiful music, Punchline, in case you were listening to music and you just got with us, it is WBAI. Roberta Maria Atti and I are talking about a condition called alexithymia. What is it? What is alexithymia? It's the difficulty identifying different kinds of feelings. That you have a feeling somewhere in your body, but you really can't tell what it is. It's the difficulty distinguishing between emotional feelings and bodily feelings. Person comes in to see me and I say, how do you feel? And they say, I have a stomach ache. Now I know they're nervous because they're sitting opposite a shrink's desk, you know, and I know there's stuff going on, but they are not connected to their emotions. A limited understanding of what caused the feelings that you're having that you can't feel but are there somewhere inside you, difficulty verbalizing feelings, limit emotional content in the imagination. Remember, they can't fantasize. Functional styles of thinking, a lack of enjoyment and pleasure-seeking because you can't anticipate the emotion that goes along with the pleasure-seeking. You see, when you think about taking a vacation with somebody says, well, shall we take a vacation? Ah, who needs a vacation? I'm here. That kind of deadness, that kind of dullness seems to grow older as people get older and older. Now, you may say, you know, that this is very much like a couple of other disorders that people, and that's what we're going to say, it's a really different thing. And those of you who are professionals, I want you to understand that alexithymia should not be confused with psychopathy. Now, psychopath is, or sociopathy, is the person who has no concern for other people.
Although they can be alexithymic.
They sure
also
can. it should not be confused with stoicism, which a lot of people deliberately resist emotional impulses. They're aware of them, but they fight them. Many people, I think, Buddhists, can be stoics in many ways. It is different than apathy, which is a lack of emotional reactivity or motivation, and different than emotional repression. Now, here are the reasons why. With the psychopath, they may be emotionally unresponsive, but, alexithymics are always social conformists. They are not social menaces. Their disposition and attitude is that there's no obvious anger that seems to be there because it's flat. It's flat feelings, flat emotions, you know? They're very different. It's not a choice. You know, for example, apathy. Apathy is the absence of emotion, particularly in situations normally considered highly emotive. Apathy also implies the absence of physiological activity in response. When a person is apathetic, they will have no immediate emotional, they will not be having all of that stuff going on in their body. Whereas the alexithymic has a tremendous, or can have tremendous physiological reactions and not have any symptom of it at all. Remember we said there were two kinds of alexithymia. One is type A, which is the one that is a result of a physical lesion or some kind of damage to the circuitry of the mind. Type B happens differently.
Type B, which is the one we call psychological, and it's also the one that is now getting less attention on the part of the medical and psychological research. The psychological alexithymia happens when the individual learns to disconnect from an emotion because he or she is afraid as a result of having experienced that emotion in a way that is too intense at least once in their lives. And so let's say that a person has experienced fear once, and it was such an enormous fear, so intense that the person felt afraid, like their mind would collapse or they might disintegrate with the intensity of that emotion. So what they might resort to as a defense mechanism is psychological alexithymia, which is the connection, the brain, the neuronal connections between that emotion and the cognitive experience of it, and or the emotion and the verbal description of it are willingly
abandoned.
Abandoned, or they're used less and less until they're no longer there.
You know, the psychological response of alexithymia clearly becomes an emotional choice. So let's go back to the child being beaten as a baby. A child is being beaten. They now have a physiological reaction that could be somebody whacked him up the back of their head with a frying pan and boom, you broke some things. Now you break things and then the child comes back and they come back like a zombie. Could be alexithymia caused by physiological type A. Type B is the child says, I can't afford to be this way, I can't afford to feel it, and shuts down the entire mechanism that will connect the emotion to consciousness. Type B is what we see in people around us. In fact, I think most of the Republican Party probably is type B.
I could agree with
you. There we go. I mean, what happens in a world when you watch people, killing people in the fields, right? And you go, oh, there go another 32 bodies were blown to pieces today. And you look at it and you go, I don't feel anything.
Well, I think there may be a way to induce alexithymia in the training of soldiers.
Well, that's another point. That was part of the reason why they were saying that the Vietnam vets coming back
Right.
We're so numb and are so dull even to this day.
Right. The training is such that they no longer, that they are not able to feel, I guess, empathy.
Yes, and but the point at which you shut it off completely, does that make you a better soldier? You know, there's always an argument. You always see the movies where John Wayne says to somebody, "It's okay to feel fear, kitty. Fear is a natural emotion." But really, the heroes are the ones who don't feel fear.
Right.
The ones who get the medals
right.
are the ones who don't feel the fear.
Don't feel actually much of anything.
And don't feel anything.
Because they're not supposed to get angry, they're not supposed to cry, they're not supposed to express any emotion.
If you ever see a hero getting a Distinguished Service Cross or some major medal, you never hear them yelling, "Whoopee." You know, you just see it's common.
You know, Armand, I have to say this because you started out with the example of the husband and wife, which is kind of a stereotype, but I mean, we do know that women have a tendency to verbalize and express and be in touch with their emotions more than men. But we thought about it, and Armand and I came up with a reason for that that makes a lot of sense. Remember, I mentioned the corpus callosum, which is that bridge between the right and left hemisphere. Well, it's well known that in women, the corpus callosum is much more developed. It's much more sophisticated. There are many more neuronal connections that go back and forth between the two hemispheres, and it is believed that the brain of females of the human species has developed in that way because women, being the nurturers of the community, they needed to develop a better verbal skill to deal precisely with emotions and feelings, not just their own, but the children's. It's very important for a child, when a child is angry, to have an adult say, "Oh, you are angry." That way the child starts to build that connection between the emotion and the word. So women have a corpus callosum that is very well developed, and it gives them that advantage of being more in touch with their emotions, but it can also be a disadvantage when they feel too much in a relationship and they're not able to turn off this, you know, the feelings and the emotions connected to that relationship.
And women who feel this way, you know, even though, you know, you might say to somebody, "Did you see her corpus callosum?" You know what I mean? Or, well, somebody who feels that they may go out of control too much will easily find themselves attracted to somebody who looks like they're in control. And that could be the man who feels nothing. So, you know, if you're somebody who believes that you could go to edges of hysteria and go crazy, you tend to look for somebody who is more in control of their emotions. Then you get together with them, and then after a while you say, you ring on their door, you knock on their chest, and they feel nothing. And there is no response. Now, all men are not alexithymic. It's a myth. Stereotypic male may not say anything about his emotions, and he may have learned to keep his mouth shut because he gets such big reactions when he talks about stuff, and he doesn't know how to communicate effectively. But he's also fiercely passionate, and he feels things about cars and football and career and house and children, and he's aware of these feelings. So it is not that a man is alexithymic automatically. It's when he doesn't feel anything about anything.
Actually, what I was alluding to was the verbal ability to describe emotions. And so you may very well be very passionate and emotional and know your feelings and know what you're feeling, but you may not want to.
Right, which is different than alexithymia.
Right.
This is Armand DeMille with you with The Positive Mind. We're talking about the alexithymic reaction, which comes out in a kind of a dullness. If you see this dullness in yourself or in others, there are things that you could do about it. We need a lot more time to talk to you about it. But let's see, alexithymics do have emotions. It's not that they don't have emotions. Much of the time, they're either unaware of the emotions in their body, you know, such as like they get, you can see them blush, or they have an elevated pulse. And they don't understand their emotional significance. When the cause and nature of the emotion is obvious, alexithymics have full-blown emotions like anyone else. Strong emotions tend to take them by surprise, but they could have emotions if they're very powerful emotions. It's not that they're completely dead. It's just those subtle emotions that escape them. Therefore, people who have this chronic dullness are prone to chronic anxiety, partly due to the failure to label their emotions properly, but they tend to make quick decisions on a gut feeling because they are nervous. There's a nervousness that builds up when you're pushing down and holding from your awareness all of these emotions, especially if it's a type 2 alexithymia.
You know, there is a book, Armand, called Deceits of the Mind and Their Effects on the Body by Jane Goldberg. She's a psychoanalyst. And that book is all about this topic. And it's really a very good book. But do you think we should say just a brief word about interoception?
I wish we could, but we have 5 minutes, so I want to give people what they can do about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And we'll pick up on this next Wednesday, all right, when we meet. Here's some self-help things you could do if you're alexithymic. First of all, you got to recognize what they call Alex in the chat rooms. You can look in the chat rooms for alexithymia, by the way, A-L-E-X-I-T-H-Y-M-I-A. You're going to be surprised how much information there is on it. People get together. The one thing you want to do is recognize it and don't ignore it. Don't try to correct your own failures by self-punishment or self-contempt. Try to develop a co-supportive relationship with a non-alexithymic person, which most people do. The dull guy, the guy who feels nothing, falls in love with somebody who feels a lot. And there's a tendency to go there because you want to try to get somebody. Now, if you can't get anybody, find a therapist who is a non-dull type. Cultivate a keener sense of people's emotional needs, judging by their verbal and physical cues, and you start listening to people's verbal cues. You learn the biggest repertoire of appropriate feeling responses you can. You have to learn. Take time and patience to learn how to recognize and name your own emotional feeling states. It takes a little time. You do a little training. There are some wonderful Gestalt exercises that do it, but alexithymics, especially alexithymia part 2, the type 2s, can be reversed. It can be reversed, and it makes all the difference, especially if you're parenting. What's it like to a child to have an alexithymic parent? It's very hard.
Very confusing, I would guess.
A guy named Finney in 1972 said, the main task in dealing with alexithymia is to break down the blocks which keeps a person from crying. He believed that the major thing here was if we could get a tear out of an alexithymic person, the tear itself will start breaking down the blocks. And I, in my 35 years of practice as a psychotherapist, absolutely agree. Almost everybody who ever comes in my office, they're coming there to shed their tears. And it's curative.
You know, there's something to say about that, because the moment that they begin to cry, even the first hint of it, they get a reward, which is the comforting behavior of the therapist. And it feels good. So that may be the encouragement to open up the floodgates and do it more.
Unless you meet a therapist who says, stop being such a baby.
Well, then
then you get in real trouble.
Right.
You know, and it's really, that's right, you get the secondary reinforcement. But the other thing that happens, in order to really cry, you got to connect with the emotion. So if you finally find the place that's safe enough to allow your tears to flow, my friends, let them flow. Remember, tears are the sweat of the heart. Your heart goes to work, your emotions are felt. Sometimes you get sad, your tears flow. It is very important to let them flow. The worst conditions we know of people who never grieve. They, like we said in the poem, you know, you don't grieve, you know, they said, Alfred, that was in Alfred Lloyd's Tennyson poem we read a little earlier, just think of it. Home they brought a warrior dead. She nor swooned nor uttered cry. All her maidens who were watching said, she must weep or she will die. Yes, that weeping is very important. Then get him or her to accept comfort while continuing to let go of their emotions through tears. That's what the therapist does or what the supporting person does. Crying is linked to loss, especially through bereavement. But if you can let somebody release the tears and you could hold them, or you could show them the comfort, the beginning of the cure takes place. This is Armand DeMille. We want to take your calls, but Roberta and I will continue with this next Wednesday when we get back. We'll be with you next Wednesday at 1 o'clock. If you want to get in touch with Roberta.
Roberta 4, the number 4, health at AOL.com.
And we will be back with you. I'll be back with you tomorrow with the head of the Washington Square Institute talking about depression and sex. Be sure to tune in at that time, my friends, on the way out. Send me an email, armand@brainlink.com, and if you want a copy of today's program, you call 212-757-4488. That's 212-757-4488.